Grant, suppressing his own pain, helped Kane put on a calf-length robe and stayed beside him as he shuffled forward. With every step, the pain in Kane's head abated and his stride became stronger. The two men walked into the small laboratory and examination room adjacent to the dispensary. Kane had peeked into it briefly shortly after his arrival at the redoubt. Since it was filled with machines and medical instruments he didn't understand, he had never made a return visit.
What are we doing here?
Putting you on the need-to-know list. Better late than never.
From a black-topped trestle table, he picked up a long-handled, two-pronged device that resembled the sensor probe used by magistrates to verify and validate ID chips of Vill citizens. This gadget, however, held a small neon tube between the prongs.
What is that thing?
An ultraviolet light projector.
How do you know?
Because that's what DeFore told me it was.
Grant thumbed a stud on the handle, and an ectoplasmic pale purple glow shone from the tube. Stepping around Kane, he pushed the wall light switch and plunged the room into semi-darkness.
Roll up your right sleeve, all the way.
Grant placed the projector a few inches above Kane's right bicep, the waxy light washing all color out of his flesh. Tiny dark markings were outlined against the skin, a series of symbols Kane recognized. They resembled three downward-pointing, elongated triangles, topped by circles. Kane stared at them, feeling a cold sickness in the pit of his stomach. Grant passed the light over the back of his right hand. Despite his deep brown complexion, identical symbols were visible.
Bridget has them too. What are they for? To brand us like goddamn cattle?
No. Their identity markings and monitors.
She regarded Kane and Grant reproachfully, but didn't chastise them.
They're the symbols of Over Project Excalibur, the insignia of the Archon Directorate.
I didn't know that.
What do you know, DeFore?
I already explained it to Bridget and Grant.
I guess I missed it. I sort of had an appointment with a coma at the time. How about bringing me up to date?
Standard Vill ID chips are little pieces of silicon injected under the skin. They react to low-frequency sound waves emitted by mag scanners. You know from your own experiences how easy those chips are to forge.
Kane nodded reluctantly. Much of his and Grant's duties as magistrates had revolved around apprehending counterfeiters of bogus ID chips.
Lockish devised a new form of identity recognition, restricted to Vill exiles. In case our numbers increase to the point where we have trouble differentiating our players from those on the other side.
We know who the players are on the other side. Everyone not in this redoubt.
Did you really think that Lakesh's overall plan was to simply fill Cerberus with exiles until it bursts at the seams? No. Once we have the numbers, we'll be given new identities and smuggled back into the Vills and the surrounding outlands. We'll act as undercover agents.
For the past 5 months or so, I've questioned Lakesh about a master strategy. He never told me even the little you just did. Why?
I've been here the longest time, nearly 3 years. You know we have SEC protocols. Probationary periods for new arrivals are part of them.
Probationary? Since I've been here, I've been shot at, blown up, beaten up, and damn near drowned. I think I've passed the fucking initiation.
DeFore cast her eyes downward in shame.
What's this about a monitor and a biolink transponder? You sewed something up inside of me?
No. The transponder is a radioactive chemical that bound itself to the glucose in your blood and a middle layer of the epidermis. It's based on organic nanotechnology and perfectly safe. It transmits heart rate, brainwave patterns, respiration, blood count, and so forth. The signal is relayed by a ComSat satellite to the redoubt.
How long have I had it in me?
It was injected after your return from Dulsa, while you were being treated for your injuries.
Nodding his fists, Kane took a menacing step toward her.
So all those injections were more than just painkillers and antibiotics. Why didn't you ask our permission?
It wasn't optional, Kane. Part of the price of sanctuary. We need to know where the exiles are, what their physical conditions are at any given moment.
In case we're recaptured. Or so she said.
You didn't happen to ask her if there's a suicide switch implanted in us by chance, did you, Grant?
Grant's eyes flashed in sudden surprise.
That's an excellent question. Is there, DeFore?
Of course not. Admittedly, we considered something along those lines, but Lakesh felt it's a bit too early to implement such measures.
Why do the transponders look like the Over Project Excalibur insignia?
That I don't know, never having seen it. Perhaps it's Lakesh's way of being ironic, like a private joke. You know what his sense of humor is like.
Yeah, he's a gifted comedian. That's it. I'm done.
What do you mean?
I mean, as soon as I feel strong enough, I'm out of here. Lakesh concocts these triple-stoop missions for us. And what have we accomplished? Nothing.
Kane.
Nothing. Tulsa, Russia, Mongolia, England, Ireland. We run around shooting these places to shit, trying not to get shot up ourselves. And what's the payoff? The Archons still pull the strings of the Barons, and the Barons pull the strings that make us all dance. I'm through.
Grant gazed steadily at his partner. He had heard Kane vent similar feelings before, but in those instances he was simply being contrary, blowing off steam. Now he heard the unmistakable edge of conviction.
Kane, try to look at it objectively. The transponder is a small enough thing, isn't it?
Ha! In size or implication? It's still a deception, and how many small deceptions have to pile up until they make a big one? I'm going back to bed.
Damn you! Didn't Grant tell you Lakesh is in Cobaltville?
He did. I told him that's not unusual.
What we're receiving from his transponder is, Lakesh has been transmitting high-stress signals for the past 2.5 days.
And?
That means he may be undergoing torture.
If that's the case, he might talk.
And if he talks, we can expect an assault from Cobaltville. All of us better be prepared to evacuate. Does Baptiste know?
Yes. She's monitoring his vital signs in the control center. She's been trying to get a precise fix on his location.
Go fetch her, Grant. Tell her we're leaving.
You tell her. You damn well know she won't abandon Lakesh.
I'll talk to her then. Did my blaster make it back with me?
Yeah, it's in the armory. Why?
Go get it for me, would you? I think I might need it.
To talk to Baptiste?
Yeah, to talk to Baptiste.
Bracketed by two console screens in the darkened control center, Bridget Baptiste manipulated a pair of keyboards. Since it was long after sunset, the overhead fluorescent strips had been dimmed to accommodate the internal clocks of the personnel. The only source of light came from the banks of data terminals. Kata manned the workstation behind her, but he didn't speak to her, as per her request, not to interrupt her concentration. On the screen to Bridget's left, the downlink telemetry transmitted from Lakesh's transponder scrolled and changed. Flashing icons indicated heart and respiration rates, as well as brainwave activity. The computer systems recorded every byte of data sent to the ComSat and directed down to the redoubt's hidden antenna array. The digital data stream was then routed to the console on her right to precisely locate Lakesh's position in time and space. Bridget had been engrossed in the computer activities for the past hour and a half, and her neck muscles felt stiff, and her eyes stung from the strain of staring at the constantly shifting jumble of letters, numbers, and symbols. Bridget stood up, taking off her former badge of office, a pair of wire-framed, rectangular-lensed eyeglasses. They were the only memento of the many years she had spent as an archivist in Cobaltville's historical division. She rolled her head. She stretched, hands at her hips, arching her back. She caught a reflection of herself in a monitor screen. The zipper on her bodysuit had opened, revealing a portion of the cleavage between her full breasts as they strained against the fabric. Bridget returned to a normal standing posture, swiftly restoring decorum to her bodysuit. She glanced surreptitiously over her shoulder at Kata, who quickly dropped his gaze to the console. He had noticed, and she felt slightly embarrassed for him, then faintly amused. Bridget rarely thought about her looks, although more than one male colleague in the division had made it plain they thought about that subject far more than she did. Her one disadvantage was that she stood out in a crowd, a true liability for living in one of the baronies. It had been worse when she was younger, because she hadn't yet proved her intellect and her drive. Now, in her late 20s and away from Cobaltville, she wasn't devalued because of her appearance or her gender. She had never considered her body more than anything but a package, locomotion for her brain. Until she met Kane, her appearance had been an afterthought. But she had found him the most attractive yet disquieting man she had ever met. She thought back to that night in her small flat in the residential enclaves. Kane's thick dark hair was just barely combed. His blue-gray eyes were so penetrating they saw through her body to the soul beneath. She remembered how, when he smiled, his eyes squinted, and when he laughed, they disappeared. At the time, despite the fear his mag's persona had evoked, she thought he was the handsomest man she had seen. The outline of a figure appeared in the open doorway of the center. She turned quickly and for a bewildered moment didn't recognize the man standing there. Then she realized it was Kane. His hair was an unruly, greasy mass, his face sporting a few days' worth of beard stubble. His complexion was sallow, eyes bagged and underlined with dark rings. His face still bore the discolored blotches of fading bruises, his lower lip swollen and puffy. He wore an open robe, and the crisscross pattern of scars he had accumulated were easily seen. Deliberately, she restrained herself from rushing to him. Kane was a proud man, absurdly so sometimes. She tried to avert her gaze, but it didn't work. She looked with increasing consternation at his slow, shuffling approach, which showed none of the wolf-like grace she had always admired. Kane stopped midway, wiped sweat from his forehead with one of the belled sleeves of his robe, and looked directly at Bridget with eyes full of pain and exhaustion.
"I think I may faint. Maybe if you're not too busy, you can keep me from bashing out what's left of my brains on the floor."
She hurried to him, letting Kane put an arm around her shoulders. As she led him to a chair, she noticed Kata unobtrusively edging out of the control center. She pulled the chair closer with her foot and helped him lower his weight gently into it.
"Good to see you, Baptiste."
He leaned back in the chair. She stood behind him, cradling his head. For a long moment, neither one of them spoke. Absently, she stroked his damp, stringy hair. At length, Kane's respiration became more regular.
"Sorry I wasn't there when you woke up."
"Just as well. I wasn't in the best of moods. Did you miss me?"
She ran a hand up the back of his neck and through the longish hair hanging there. She didn't answer. The question confused her, made her emotions feel like they were trapped in a sandbag. Right before they had risked the interphaser transit in England, Kane had grabbed her, held her, as if he were taking advantage of quite possibly the final opportunity to tell or show her how he felt about her. He hadn't embraced her, hadn't kissed her.
"See you on the other side. Anamkara."
Then he had walked into the interface field and vanished into a pocket of non-space. She wasn't sure if Kane was aware she had learned the meaning of Anamkara. She doubted he did. It was an old Gaelic term meaning soul friend. Turning his head, Kane looked up at her. A little of the old high-voltage insouciance glinted in his eyes.
"I asked you a question."
She removed her hands from his head and stepped away.
Yes. We've got a situation, and I need your expertise. Have you talked to Grant?"
"Yeah. Lakesh has gone missing."
"That's not quite accurate. We know where he is."
"Cobaltville."
"I configured and triangulated the transponder signal. Here he is."
On the screen glowed a jumble of lines, curves, and squares, glowing green against black. The view was centered on a series of interconnected box shapes. Inside one of them, a red dot pulsed. He instantly recognized the layout.
"The admin monolith. Level E. The convicted felon blocks. The mags have him."
"At least one mag in particular. Salvo."
Kane leaned back, staring vacantly at the Mercator map on the far wall.
"No surprise that Lakesh had the floor plan and the specs for the admin monolith in the database."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"No surprise that he bugged us, implanted us with those transponders without asking our permission, or even mentioning them to us."
"I don't think you grasp..."
"Enough. Let's be straight with each other for once. Both of us hate to be wrong, so we tend to snipe at each other instead of communicating."
"Go on, then."
"I'm not about to stroll into the lion's den for that two-faced, double-crossing bag of bones. I'm tired of us, even his pet, Domi, being used as expendable tools."
"He's suffering torture. What if he's made to talk about this place?"
"Let him talk. Let this place be overrun. We'll be long gone, either through the gateway or overland in the Sandcat. Maybe he's been captured, or maybe it's what he wants us to think. Either way, Lakesh is on his own."
"You don't mean that, Kane."
"Every goddamn word."
"You bastard. You can pack up and run, but I'm going after him."
"That's where you're mistaken, Baptiste. You're not going after him."
"Who'll stop me?"
"I will. I'll break one of your legs if I have to, but you're not going to Cobaltville."
Bridget jackknifed up out of the chair.
"You couldn't break a toothpick in your condition, Kane."
"Then I'll shoot you in the leg. Lakesh has put you in harm's way for the last time, Baptiste. All for nothing. It ends now."
Bridget held herself very still, very quiet. Inwardly, she cursed herself for not suspecting that Kane's head trauma could induce a form of dementia.
You don't need a blaster with me, Kane.
Don't patronize me. I'm not a jolt brain. I'm not fused out. I'm thinking very clearly. I've made the decision and I'm sticking by it.
What does Grant think? And Domi? What if they don't abide by the decision you've made for us?
They'll have the same choice you have. Leg breaking or leg shooting.
There's more to this than simply saving Lakesh, you know.
There always is in this place.
I've got the memory disk from the interfacer.
So what?
I can't analyze it.
Why not? Aren't you a semi-genius on top of having a photographic memory?
It's in Lakesh's own personal mathematical language. Multiple option logarithmic philosophy. It's beyond me. Beyond the encryption keys of the database.
What's that got to do with anything?
She fixed her green eyes on his pale, drawn face.
What do you remember of the time between stepping into the interphase field in Strongbow's place and the time you woke up?
Nothing.
You're lying, Kane. Think. Please. What is it?
I had a dream about my father.
Anything else? Anything at all?
I remember like a jump dream, only it was like I was in the past, long before the nuke, in a city. I was invisible. But I saw a man, a very important man, get chilled.
An important man?
More important than just because he was a leader or famous. He was important because his death meant that the next step of a plan could go forward. I saw another man, but he looked, I don't know how to describe him, but he looked fake, like somebody who really wasn't a man, but only playing at being one. Does that make any sense?
Yes. Go on.
This man, or whatever, was connected to the assassination, to the plan. He knew I was there. He told me I couldn't do anything to stop him. I hated him like I hate the Baron.
The man you saw murdered, do you remember his name?
Something with a hard C or a K. Keneally? Connolly?
Kennedy?
Yeah, Kennedy. Now I remember. One of the pre-dark presidents.
President John F. Kennedy. 35th President of the United States. You were present at his assassination on November 22, 1963, in Dallas, Texas. There was also a man named Connolly. John Connolly was the governor of Texas at the time. He was injured in the shooting.
It could have been a jump dream.
One that happens to coincide with an actual historical event? One that happened over 200 years ago? And one that few people outside of the historical division are even aware of anymore? You're not that obtuse, are you?
What made you ask if I remembered anything?
Because Grant, Domi, and myself all experienced some kind of temporal shift during the interphase transit. We were non-corporeal, like you, visiting the past in a pan-physical state, so we couldn't effect a causality violation even if we wanted to. Each of those past time periods seemed to be pivotal points in history that apparently led to the present-day circumstances. The unifying factor in those events was the false human you described. When you saw him, was he dressed in black, wearing dark glasses?
Mm-hmm.
As he was in all of our experiences. A man in black, known in the vernacular of the 20th century as an MIB.
Baptiste, I'm not interested in a fake MIB. He's not the topic.
The hell he isn't.
She reached down to the left-hand console and plucked up a small CD-ROM disc.
Locked on this disk, in a language only Lakesh can translate, is the path to changing the road of the present. Remember what he told us about Operation Kronos? It was a major component of the totality concept, spun off from the Project Cerberus successes.
Yeah, the totality concept. A secret military undertaking that researched all sorts of crazy stuff, including time travel. But according to Lakesh, Operation Kronos only had one success.
Bridget nodded, recalling what Lakesh had told her about the many failures of Kronos, of translating a test animal's head into the past, while the rest of the wretched creature remained in the present. Not until Lakesh's Project Cerberus phased a living subject along a quantum pathway and wholly reintegrated it, did Operation Kronos work the bugs out of temporal dilation.
Lakesh also said that Kronos disrupted the structure of time and triggered a probability wave dysfunction that led to the nuke cost, and then led to...
He broke off, suddenly realizing the weight of his recitation and its implications. Bridget knew the thoughts chasing each other through his mind.
Led to this lousy present time. Lakesh always claimed the Holocaust was preventable, that Operation Kronos had created an alternate event horizon. He wasn't just theorizing, Kane. What all of us witnessed as an accidental byproduct of the Interphaser proves that time travel is possible.
Even if we can go back in time, what good could we do, floating around like ghosts?
I believe that was a phenomenon related to the Interphase field. Lakesh built it to interface with natural quantum vortex points, like the megaliths in England and Ireland. The Interphaser wasn't designed to operate as either a portable gateway unit or a time machine. Somehow, it accidentally did both. The reasons why and how it can be intentionally duplicated are embedded on this disk. It could be our only chance of setting right what the Archon Directorate put wrong all those centuries ago. Whatever you may think, I'm not determined to risk my life to rescue Lakesh for purely sentimental reasons. Kane, do you remember what you said to me back in Strongbow's place? You said you'd pay me back.
You told me I owed you nothing.
I'm taking it back. I'm asking you to help me retrieve Lakesh before he dies or before he talks. Not even for his particular life, but for all the millions, the billions of lives needlessly snuffed out in the Nukecost and the Skydark.
He didn't respond. His eyes were fixed and vacant on some faraway point.
Kane, will you help me?
Anamkara.
As the Sin Eater vanished, he pushed himself stiffly to his feet as if he were 90 years old.
Give me an hour to clean up, dress, and get something to eat. Then we'll discuss tactics.
He walked toward the door of the control complex.
Kane? Kane!
Now what?
Would you really have shot me?
He stopped in mid-stride, turning toward her. A thin, slight smile played over his lips.
Of course not. Grant took out the bullets before he gave it to me. I guess he figured I wouldn't know the difference. Or you wouldn't.
You tried to bluff me.
That makes us even, Baptiste.
For a long time, longer than Lakesh could recall, the damp stone walls, the dim light bulb burning overhead, and the hard, hard bench had been his universe. The broad straps locked over his midsection and his legs, as well as the leather cuffs buckled around his wrists, severely limited his horizons. Pain, of course, had become an integral part of this universe. It was the only means he had of marking the passage of time. When Selvo and Pollard, always together, never separately, made their visits, the pain and questions would begin. Sometimes there were no questions at all, just the application of pain. Lakesh found himself looking forward to the routine and grew a little anxious when it varied. He retained enough clarity of reason to know that was the true horror of torture, the intimate, almost sexual relationship that sometimes developed between victim and victimizer. At first, the psychological distance between the two was immense, but if the routine continued long enough, if the periods of isolation between them were extended, that divide narrowed until the victim actually welcomed the torturer, eager for any kind of exchange. Although Lakesh had spent the first part of his adult life as a physicist, he had read more than scientific journals. At university, he minored, for a while at least, in psychology. He remembered a reference in one of the textbooks to the depraved Marquis de Sade and his justification for causing pain.
Heaven has decreed that it is your part to endure these sufferings, just as it is my part to inflict them.
Selvo had probably never heard of de Sade, but he was determined to be the perverted Frenchman's spiritual successor. During the first few sessions, Lakesh had managed to construct a bunker in his mind that the pain couldn't reach. For a while, the mental walls had held fast against the assaults of electricity, of sleep deprivation, and the withholding of food and water. He wasn't sure when it had happened, but the pain had breached the walls and become all there was. He couldn't remember a time without it, or visualize a future where it did not rain. An infinitesimally tiny section of his mind recognized the onset of despair and despondency. Lakesh lay on the bench, closed his eyes, and ignored it. He didn't open his eyes until he felt a warm breath on his right cheek, smelled a stale odor. Selvo's face hung a foot above his. The man's dark eyes were dull, no longer swirling with liquid madness. His breath came out of his nose and mouth in shallow puffs. He looked profoundly exhausted. His lips moved in a forced, stitched-on smile.
Have we had a moment of breakthrough, old man?
Lakesh heard the soft, rustling whisper, but couldn't summon up the energy or interest to respond to it.
You haven't answered my question. That's very impolite.
Lakesh gazed unblinkingly into Salvo's eyes. He kept his gaze fixed and unremitting. Salvo blinked first, and Lakesh slowly closed his eyes. Straightening up, Salvo ran a hand through his short, dark hair. When his fingertips touched the weald scar on his scalp, he jerked them away.
The old prick is faking, sir. A few jolts of direct current will perk him up. Or we could start breaking some bones, small ones at first.
No, the shock would chill him. He's already prepared to die.
Let him. The bastard is defying our authority. Death is the least of what he's earned.
Salvo studied the man strapped to the bench. The wrinkled skin looked like paper out of a pre-dark book. The ash-colored hair was limp and the body was shriveled. The eyes sunk deep in their sockets. So much time, so much pain, and so little to show for it. Intellectually, Salvo knew there was nothing remarkable or admirable about Lakesh's dogged resistance to torture. It was simply single-mindedness, a spiteful determination not to surrender anything through force. He had seen such stubbornness before, and it inevitably faltered, weakened, and collapsed altogether. Sometimes it collapsed into gibbering insanity, more often into a gradual wasting away, followed by death. He turned toward the door.
He's no good to us, Dad. We need to restore him to some kind of health so we can begin again. I'll arrange for a medic to come down here and give him stimulants and vitamins. Until then, you're not to touch him, understand?
Understood,
Salvo left the cell and strode through the cell blocks. He drew near the termination room. The door to the room was up, and he glanced into the room as he walked past. The overhead fluorescent lights blazed down on four mags in full armor. Their jet-black figures contrasted sharply with the blank, featureless walls. Smoke twisted in pale planes in the air. A naked woman sagged in a set of wrist and leg shackles against the far wall. It was pocked with old and new bullet holes. The yellow bodysuit worn by the condemned lay wadded on the floor in a corner. They wore it only on the short, final walk from a cell to the termination room. Three rounds had drilled dark holes in her chest, grouped neatly over her heart. The fourth had punched through her forehead, and a thick mixture of blood and brains oozed down the wall behind her. Termination squads always consisted of four mags, and one always aimed for the head. The magistrate selected to fire the telling headshot was always known as the chosen man. It was part of some old, murky tradition, which Salvo had never quite understood or cared enough about to investigate. Since the termination room was on E-level, the manufacturing facility, the corpse was left in a bin so it might be rendered down to its useful chemical components. Hair, bone, skin, none of it went to waste. Months ago, the same fate was decreed for Bridget Baptiste's treasonous life, but one member of her termination squad had been Kane. He had penciled in a new ending. The corridor ended at an elevator tube.
Approaching D-level. Approaching C-level. C-level.
Salvo's office was small, far smaller than his ambitions, and shaped like an oval with one end sliced off. He keyed the stack of daily intel reports transmitted along the Vil network on his desk, but he didn't waste his time thumbing through them. He knew none of them would contain even the vaguest clue to the whereabouts of Kane, Baptiste, or Grant. Whatever hole they dug to hide themselves in, it was deep, dark, and far from the eyes of the Barons. Only Lakesh could point it out. At least Salvo hoped he could. No, prayed he could. He stepped to the window behind his desk, staring out at the fat-faced Colorado moon. He grudgingly admitted that Lakesh was a strong man, far stronger than he had ever imagined. Human strength was not a quality to be admired any longer. The program of unification had been devoted to stamping it out, to crushing the spirit that fueled it. Humanity had to be prevented from aspiring to any fate beyond simply surviving from day to day. That spirit had very nearly been obliterated on January 20, 2001, when an atomic hellstorm effectively vaporized four-fifths of the planet's population. The 25-year-long nuclear winter that followed the Sky Dark accounted for millions more. He wondered about Lakesh's human spirit, why it was so tough and resilient. It was easy for a torturer to strip the victim of all symbols of identity and reduce him to a state of total dependency, whereby the provision of the bare necessities of life was dependent on cooperation. Mixing pain with interrogation at irregular intervals and sleep deprivation was a standard method of completely disorienting a prisoner. But applying the process properly required the luxury of time, a commodity that was in short supply for Salvo. An old man who presumably had lived on the cushioned tyranny of the Baron for most of his life should have been broken within the first day. He should have sobbed like a child and begged to tell Salvo what he knew. Now, the third day drew to a close, and all that his and Pollard's efforts had elicited was an old song performed off-key in a horribly cracked voice about luck being a lady. That had been the start. After 3 days, Lakesh wasn't singing anymore. He was dying, deliberately ending his life to spite his captors. Salvo pivoted away from the window, absently fingering the scar seaming his forehead, cutting down to the corner of his left eye. He knew he couldn't detain Lakesh much longer, even though the man's unexplained absences from the Ville were the subject of gossip and envy. On any given day, Baron Cobalt might summon him for a private audience, or even call an unscheduled meeting of the Trust. Salvo had no idea why the Baron seemed so attached to the ancient, stubborn historian. He had considered trumping up charges and manufacturing evidence against him like he had done with Abrams, but Baron Cobalt would be sure to detect a frame, not a coincidence. Abrams had been summarily executed as a traitor only two sunrises ago. As the Magistrate Division Administrator, Salvo was next in line to assume his position. However, he had yet to be informed, officially or otherwise, of a pending promotion. All magistrates followed a patrilineal tradition, assuming the duties and positions of their fathers before them. Continuing the tradition of duty should have been a sufficient life purpose, and as Salvo was promoted through the ranks, he found each upgrade satisfying, but it was a numb kind of satisfaction. Always came the yearning, the craving for more. He fed the cravings by actions that, if discovered, would have slated him for immediate execution. Through intimidated pit denizens, particularly the late boss Guana Teague, Salvo had covertly established a highly effective spy service, with conduits stretching into the outlands. He always knew what was going on within a 50-mile radius and who was doing it. Rarely did he use this inside knowledge for personal gain, except to shore up his growing, fearsome reputation as a merciless enforcer. When, 5 years ago, Abrams sponsored his induction into the Trust, Salvo felt that his talents and superior skills were being recognized at last. He belonged to the most elite body on Earth, the ultimate secret society, entrusted with the history of humanity and its intertwined fate with the Archon Directorate. In a short time, Salvo grew disenchanted again. He had more power, but not nearly enough. He still had to maintain the facade of a mag commander, dealing with 100 picayune details every day, forced to solve mundane problems that held no interest for him whatsoever. He desired an assignment that only he could perform, an assignment that would prove to Baron Cobalt and his fellow members of the Trust just how exceptionally valuable he was. That assignment came to him some months ago, due in the main to fortuitous circumstances he had unknowingly helped to set into motion. Thinking about Teague, Milton Reith, and the processing center he had established in Mesa Verde Canyon always brought his thoughts back around to Kane. He fingered the scar again, this time angrily, probing it with his fingers until he felt a pinch of pain. Kane had given him that scar nearly 6 months before, and less than 2 weeks ago had taunted him about it.
"You've healed well. Not every asshole I've pistol-whipped can say that, you know."
Memories of those weeks of pain during his recovery, of enduring the humiliation of defeat, drove away any lingering doubts about the reasons he had Lakesh in custody. The old man was the key to finding Kane, and he had to find a way to use him. Salvo stiffened, whirling around to face the Transcom unit on his desk. He stared at the small box of molded plastic and stamped metal as if it had transformed into a bat, screeching his downfall. Baron Cobalt had summoned the Trust. As usual, the briefing took place in the dining hall. Although the third level held a formal briefing room, it was never used. The dining hall was more intimate, inasmuch as most of the briefings rarely involved more than six people. Seated around a table in a corner, Grant, Brigid, Kane, Domi, and DeFore were sharing a pot of one of the few perks of living in Cerberus, genuine coffee. Coffee had been one of the casualties of the nuke cost, almost completely disappearing from the face of the continental United States. A bitter synthetic gruel known as sub had replaced it. Whether the name derived from substitute or substandard, no one knew. Fortunately, the redoubt had tons of freeze-dried caches of the real stuff, stockpiled for the original residents of Cerberus. DeFore thumbed through a stack of spreadsheet printouts. The jagged lines and squiggles meant very little to the others, but DeFore had red-circled sections of the graph.
Several days ago, the first signs of stress were transmitted. Increased brainwave activity, heart rate, and respiration became irregular. They stabilized for several hours, though still erratic. Then they spiked again, stayed that way for about 3 hours, and flattened out. That's been the pattern for the past couple of days.
In your medical opinion, Lakesh is being subjected to torture?
That's the only answer for these consistently erratic readings.
She eyed Kane surreptitiously, noting the slight unsteadiness in the hand lifting the cup to his lips. Though he had shaved, showered, and attired himself in a white bodysuit, the standard uniform of Cerberus personnel, he still looked wan and weak.
Oh man, heart might give out. He could die.
He's old right enough, chronologically a shade under 250 years. Physically, though, he's middle-aged and he's pretty sound.
How can that be? He was nearly 50 when he went into cryogenic stasis shortly after the nuke cost. He claimed he was revived about 50 years ago, so his physical age should be closer to 100.
He looks that old. Older.
True, but his major organs were replaced upon his resuscitation. He's got a new heart, a new set of lungs, and he's on a second pair of eyes.
Second?
Yes. Haven't you ever wondered why an East Indian has a pair of baby blues?
Since none of them had ever met an East Indian other than Lakesh, they had no frame of reference, so none of them had ever wondered about his eye color.
So, Lakesh is in good physical condition. To have all that reconstructive and invasive surgery done, he obviously has a high tolerance for pain. Certain kinds, anyway.
You mean that doddering around he does is an act?
Essentially, yes. He found it kept him fairly free of suspicion.
Until now. The arrogant bastard has been playing the odds for years. He should have known they wouldn't always be in his favor. Salvo isn't a fool.
No, but he's not quite sane either.
She didn't elaborate on her meeting with the man when she awaited trial and execution for treason. Salvo had mentioned his deep hatred of Kane without delving into the reasons behind it. And during the disastrous op in Idaho a couple of weeks before, Salvo had indulged in a paroxysm of jealous, homicidal rage over the very concept that Kane had sacrificed and betrayed everything for her.
Salvo may chill Lakesh if he's too stubborn to cooperate.
I think it's safe to assume he's been stubborn. Otherwise, this place would be under a full mag assault by now.
Speaking of magistrates, do you have an idea of what kind of techniques they may be using on him?
Grant and Kane exchanged discomfited glances, both feeling a little on the spot. But as former mags, they were the logical ones to answer that line of questioning.
We were hard contact magistrates. Most interrogations were carried out by intel officers.
Still, you'd have sat in on a session or two.
Standard opening is to soften up the perp with physical abuse. A beating, severe enough to cause pain but not permanent damage. If that didn't work, then electric shock was applied. Deprivation of sleep, food, and water, except for the bare minimum to stay alive. No toilet privileges, so the perp lay in his own filth. Depending on the nature of the crime, drugs were used.
Psychotropics? Truth drugs?
No, nerve toxins that would cause pain and convulsions. That was usually saved for near the end, after the perps had their arms and legs broken.
Bridget winced, imagining the agony of muscles convulsing uncontrollably, of shattered limbs thrashing about in a seizure.
The victim would probably die of shock inside a few minutes, especially if he were in a debilitated physical state. Judging by the transponder readings, they haven't resorted to that method yet.
They probably will, sooner or later.
Then it's of paramount importance we get Lakesh out of there, sooner rather than later.
Our options of penetrating both Cobaltville and the admin monolith are limited. We've only got two choices. Overland and a Sandcat will require at least a week's travel time, but it's the simplest. The second choice is to use the gateway and jump directly from here. Lakesh said there's a secret Matrans unit in the monolith.
Yeah, on A-level, the Baron's quarters.
According to Lakesh, it's a unit known to very few outside of his personal staff. It's hidden away, more than likely unguarded.
Bry ran a diagnostic on the system after all of you returned. If he'd found any problems, I guess he would have said so.
He's going to have to say for sure before I climb into that goddamn thing again.
What about Mesa Verde Gateway? The way we got here? Maybe we jump there?
It was a modular unit, set up in the Cliff Palace to transport Outlanders to the genetics facility in New Mexico. After we used it to escape, it was dismantled.
Besides, we'd still have to contend with the overland travel problem. We'd be on foot and hiking for days through a hell zone. We'd be sick with rad poisoning long before we came within sight of Cobaltville. DeFore, we'll need you on this op, just in case Lakesh requires immediate medical attention.
The woman's liquid brown eyes widened in surprise, then fear. Kane knew he was asking a lot of her. As one of Lakesh's first exiles, spirited out of Ragnarville to the north, she was still so fearful of being apprehended again, she rarely ventured beyond the redoubt sectors.
Understood.
Domi, you know every slag hole in Tartarus, right?
You betcha. I can walk around blindfolded.
Let's hope it doesn't come to that. We'll need you in case we're cut off from the gateway when we have to make our escape.
Although born in the Outlands, Domi had entered Cobaltville with a bogus ID chip provided by the former pit boss of Tartarus, the late and largely unlamented Guana Teague. As in every ville, Cobaltville had its own planned ghetto, a sublevel known as the Tartarus Pits, and Domi had learned her way around very well. Like many other young Outland women, Domi had been lured into the pits by the promise of a better life on the provision she supplied a term of sex service to Guana Teague. For months, she was little more than a slave to the depraved lusts of the grotesque man-mountain of Flab. The term of service came to an abrupt end when Domi cut Teague's throat.
DeFore, can we assume that Salvo knows nothing of Lakesh's biolink transponder?
I served in Ragnarville's medical service for better than 5 years. If the Vills had something like it, I would have heard about it.
I was a mag for better than 15 years, and I never heard about the Archon Directorate until 6 months ago.
Kane.
All right. We'll operate on the assumption this isn't a trap, orchestrated by either Lakesh or Salvo.
We don't have much time.
Grant, Domi, DeFore, we'll meet in the ready room at 1300 hours.
For a handful of seconds, Bridget wondered if Kane's omission of her name was an oversight.
What kind of equipment do you want me to bring?
None.
Why not?
Because you're not going.
Who gave you the authority to make that decision?
Consider it a field promotion, Baptiste. There's no reason for you to be a part of the team. An op like this requires a minimal number of personnel. 4 is a nice round figure. More only adds a name to a possible casualty or prisoner list.
I have as much...
What was it you called yourself a couple of weeks ago? Bridget Baptiste, girl hostage?
Bridget swept her furious gaze over Domi and Grant, looking for either support or sympathy. Domi averted her eyes, but Grant met her stare from beneath a furrowed brow.
Kane's right. This is the riskiest op we've ever been on. DeFore's presence may be essential to bringing Lakesh back here alive. Yours isn't.
Am I supposed to be grateful that you're looking out for my safety? Or sparing me the embarrassment of being captured again?
Maybe not now. Later you might be.
You said you'd help me retrieve him.
Which I'm doing. There was absolutely nothing said about you coming along. And don't delude yourself into thinking I'm trying to protect you. I didn't make this decision out of chivalry.
Why, then?
You said the Interfacer's memory disk held the secret to time travel.
I did, but I also said only Lakesh can analyze the data.
And if Lakesh dies, or if none of us makes it back, who's the next most qualified person in Cerberus to find the analysis key, no matter how long it might take? Answer me.
I am.
Exactly. remember what you said about saving billions of lives that weren't supposed to be snuffed out?
I have an eidetic memory. I don't need you to remind me of anything.
Good. DeFore, I'm gonna need a painkiller that won't make me woozy, and a stimulant to keep me sharp.
I can give you those.
Kane started walking toward the exit.
Grant, we'll go in fully armored. We can't silence the Sin Eaters, so we'll bring the Copperheads, too.
Affirmative. We should take grenades and a sign.
The sign, or Nemosign, was a digital decryptor, small enough to carry in one hand, but capable of overriding the most complex of electronic locks.
That man is a vanadium-hearted son of a bitch!
That's why Lakesh needs him.
Salvo strode purposefully down the corridor, away from the office suites, past the recessed armory sector. He turned right down a narrow, windowless hallway. After 20 paces, it ended at a locked service access door. Instead of a service access, there was an elevator shaft, barely large enough to accommodate two men. Lock solenoids snapped into place automatically, and the disc shot upward. Salvo moved quickly across the down ramp and into a magnificently appointed foyer. Glittering light cast from many crystal chandeliers flooded every corner of the entrance hall. A member of the elite baronial guard stood at stiff attention before the gold and ivory inlaid double doors. Usually two of the red and white uniformed men were on duty, but tonight only a burly blonde man stood there. The baronial guard opened the right-hand door, and as he expected, he strode into a deep, almost primal dark. Salvo kept walking, knowing where he was going. He wasn't surprised by the unscheduled meeting of the Trust. This was Baron Cobalt's demonstration, held at a deliberately inconvenient hour without prior notice, to show that he was the unquestioned master of every detail in the lives of his servitors. Salvo passed through a wide, low arch into another room, and then another. As he approached the fifth and final room, his sure stride faltered. Before him blazed an incandescent golden flare, glowing like a miniature sun in the gulfs of space. Salvo walked slowly toward it, an icy hand seeming to stroke his spine. Cold sweat beaded his skin. He came to a stop in the center of the enormous Persian carpet covering the floor and faced the archway. It was awash with a pale yellow luminescence, like veils of smoke dusted with particles of gold. Beyond the veils, he saw a vague and familiar shape swaying slightly. No other members of the Trust stood in a formal semicircle on the carpet. The gong had not chimed to announce Baron Cobalt's arrival. The entire ritual of assembling the Trust and the Baron's theatrical appearance had been dispensed with. Salvo was completely alone with Baron Cobalt. Distantly, he realized the short hairs on the nape of his neck had lifted, scraping against the high collar of his uniform. All the moisture dried in his mouth, and he fought against the mad impulse to turn and race back the way he had come, like a panicked deer, the trapped animal buried within the human psyche cringing away before his reasoning centers grasped the uniquely awful import of the moment. A small number of people had private audiences with the Baron, and those few were members of his personal staff. As far as Salvo knew, the general membership of the Trust did not even know his true appearance. Certainly Salvo had never seen Baron Cobalt without his theatrical trappings. He knew the Baron utilized a psychological ploy to intimidate and solidify the master-servant relationship between him and the Trust. But that knowledge didn't make it easier to endure. Salvo was still shaken with a primordial fear. The hierarchy of Barons claimed to be hybrids of human and Archons. Salvo wasn't certain about those claims, since he had never seen an Archon, just as he had never seen one of the baronial hierarchy in the flesh. As far as he really knew, the Barons could be new strains of Muti, genetically scrambled mutations spawned by the nuke cost. But it wasn't the question of Baron Cobalt's ancestry that sent fear exploding through him. It was the certainty that the Baron could end his life on a whim and with a single word. Or worse, extend that life in sanity-shattering agony until, wearying of keeping him alive, the Baron would speak another word, and Salvo would cease to exist so suddenly and thoroughly it would be as if he had never lived at all. The figure behind the gold-speckled curtain paced incessantly. A gaunt man-shape under 6 feet tall, with unusually long arms and unusually short legs. His face was always in shadow, but occasionally Salvo caught glimpses of a long, narrow face and a high-domed, hairless skull. The color and shape of the Baron's eyes were still a mystery to Salvo.
You must be rather surprised to find yourself before me, and not in the company of your fraternity.
Salvo lowered his head, not daring to speak, for fear that the tremor in his voice would betray him.
Abrams, as you know, was executed 3 days ago. Perhaps you've wondered why I have not formally named you his successor.
My Lord Baron has many matters of state to occupy him.
You grovel nicely, Salvo, but it is not required at this time. As for my occupations, I confess my thoughts turn more and more toward the rancorous events of the last two seasons.
Salvo didn't have to ask Baron Cobalt to clarify, even had he the nerve to do so. The events of the past 5.5 months were, in all likelihood, the most scandalous in the 87-year history of the Unified Vils. Kane had learned too much during the op to chill Milton Reith and shut down his processing center. Rather than have a decorated magistrate chilled, Salvo had inducted him into the Trust. His reasons were many, and so complex even he didn't understand them all. Primarily, the prospect of holding Kane's fate in his hands had been too attractive to ignore. The idea of forcing an independent man like Kane to become vulnerable to his slightest wish had been almost sexual in its intensity. He remembered how Abrams had accused him of hatching an ill-conceived and perverse plan. Even Lakesh commented that he possessed a talent for cruel irony. Replaying the old historian's words, Salvo suddenly doubted himself. Setting up Abrams as a traitor had been a way to divert the Baron from Salvo's real plans for Lakesh. Now he wondered if his loathing of Kane hadn't blinded him to reality. Both Abrams and Lakesh had lodged objections to the induction of Kane. On Lakesh's part, his rebuke could have been a pose, but... Baron Cobalt's voice yanked his attention outward.
Over the years in the other vills, a few magistrates turned renegade, but they didn't possess the knowledge of our true work, like Kane. Most of them were tracked and put to other uses. Kane's own father is the most recent example of that practice.
Yes, Lord Baron.
Your own father's relationship with the elder Kane was a bit on the curious side, wasn't it?
Salvo's heart fluttered inside his chest. Baron Cobalt's pacing stopped. Though Salvo couldn't see his eyes, he felt the heat of his stare through the pastel curtain.
I also find it a bit on the curious side why you chose the name Grudge for the task force I allowed you to form. A task force dedicated to the sole aim of running down a single traitor. A traitor you brought into my fold.
My lord,
Be still. I admit I allowed my fury with Kane to cloud my reasoning. I am not accustomed to experiencing such strong visceral emotions as anger and hatred, and therefore I did not perceive the pattern, at least not immediately. But when I did, I checked our genetic database.
My lord, I don't understand.
Perhaps you truly do not. Even after I explain it, you may still not understand. You have heard of Over Project Excalibur?
Salvo nodded, thoughts racing wildly. Over Project Excalibur had been a division of the totality concept dealing with the bioengineering of life forms. The three subdivisions of Excalibur were Calypso, Invictus, and Joshua.
Joshua's role in the Over Project was the mapping of human genomes to specific chromosomal functions and locations, so the directorate would have genetic samples of the best of the best after the new cost. In the vernacular of the time, it was known as purity control. After the program of unification had been instituted, the egg cells were developed to embryos. Through ectogenesis techniques, fetal development outside of the body eliminated the role of the mother until after birth. The genes in the egg cells were manipulated to reduce the hereditary relevance of both parents, to break the connection between mother, father, and child. That break was crucial in order for the unification program to succeed. The existence of the family as a unit of procreation, and therefore as a social unit, had to be eliminated. You, and everyone else who enjoys full Vil citizenship, are the descendants of that undertaking. Sometimes a particularly desirable trait was grafted to an unrelated egg, or an undesirable trait removed. As you may imagine, there were many failures. However, when there was a success, it was replicated over and over, occasionally with modifications. but the basic genetic foundation remained unchanged. The best example is myself and my brother Barons. Contained within us are superior traits collected from an equal number of humans and Archons. Some of that genetic material was supplied by the Cain line. Yes, that makes Cain and myself related, after a fashion. I told him this myself in Dulsa, though I overstated it a bit for effect. Do you begin to understand what I am leading to? Do you know the difference between identical and fraternal twins? No? Identical twins result when a single fertilized egg splits and develops into two separate but duplicate organisms, a form of natural, accidental cloning. Fraternal twins, by contrast, occur when two different sperm fertilize two different eggs within the same womb. Need I continue?
The carpet seemed to split beneath Salvo's feet. He rocked, as if he tottered on the edge of an abyss or on the crumbling lip of hell. Baron Cobalt fell silent, swaying slightly like a reed in a gentle breeze. Salvo glared at him through a cloud of tears. The Baron said no more. He preferred to unleash all of Salvo's hidden demons and watch with amusement as they shredded and gutted everything that he was.
Say it, you inhuman bastard. And in saying it, damn my father as a liar, as a deceiver. He told me Cain's father had stolen the woman selected for him, pulled rank, laughed about his victory. Say it, that my father lied when he claimed Cain's father set out to humiliate him, make him an object of scorn in the division. Tell me how the Cain line possessed qualities superior to the Salvos, and that's why the arrangement was changed. Go ahead, my Lord Baron. Tell me that I sprang from the Cain stock. Tell me that I've wasted all these years hating a man who is my own genetic brother. Tell me something I didn't already know.
I can see you've managed to grasp the subtleties. And finally, we reach the apex of this intimate heart-to-heart. Salvo, you orchestrated the entire sequence of events from the moment you chose Cain to be a member of the Penetration Squad into Mesa Verde. You sponsored him into the Trust. You performed an admirable job of arranging his escape and concealing your own complicity in it. You petitioned me to form the Grudge Task Force so you could take a more active hand in Cain's seditious activities. When Abrams became suspicious, you framed him with manufactured evidence. Now my good friend Lakesh has vanished. My guard reported you were last seen with him. I submit, Lakesh grew suspicious just like Abrams, but rather than setting him up, since not even you are so arrogant to believe I would accept the exposure of two traitors in such a short time, you absconded with him.
Salvo's stomach turned a series of flip-flops. He shivered, biting down on his tongue to keep his teeth from chattering.
My lord, you are mistaken.
Although I fall prey to errors of judgment, I never make mistakes.
Salvo sensed shadows shifting behind him and started to turn. Searing pain lanced from the back of his neck to the base of his spine. He lay stunned, blinking at the two figures looming. One wore the uniform of a baronial guardsman. He wielded a black 3-foot-long baton that Salvo dazedly identified as a mag-issue shock stick. The second figure took him longer to recognize. He was a tall man, holding what at first glance seemed to be another shock stick. On second glance, Salvo saw it was a cane, a walking stick. The man holding it had hair and a beard the color of iron. A smile of triumph creased his weather-beaten face.
Abrams?
Get up!
When Salvo didn't immediately move, the guardsman thrust down threateningly with the tip of the shock stick. He got to his knees and stayed there.
No! No! No!
Baron Cobalt thrust aside the iridescent curtain and approached him, walking in a mannered, graceful stride. Salvo gazed at him, seeing clearly for the first time his master, his deity. The Baron's slender figure was encased in a golden bodysuit, which matched the almost translucent golden hue of his complexion. The smooth, almost poreless skin was stretched tight over protuberant facial bones, all sharp angles of cheeks, brow, and chin. The elongated skull tapered from a high, round, completely bald skull down to a pointed chin. There were no lines on the face, not even on the high forehead. Below that, large, slanting, golden-brown eyes stared out from deep sockets. The thin slash of the mouth showed only authority and amused contempt. Salvo tried to keep his gaze steady, faintly recalling something he had read that those who look on the face of their god would be struck dead.
Lord Baron, I am yours, ever and always. I have served you faithfully.
Humans serve only themselves, their own venal ambitions for power, for material goods. They need a cause to cloak their greed. That trait cannot seem to be bred out of the race. It must be burned out.
Baron Cobalt's eyes looked down upon him contemplatively. He smiled a sad, almost fond smile.
We will begin that cleansing with you.
At 12:30 hours, Grant and Domi entered the armory. The big square room was stacked nearly to the ceiling with wooden crates and boxes. Many of the crates were stenciled with the legend, Property U.S. Army. Glass-fronted cases lined the four walls. Automatic assault rifles were neatly racked in a case, and a nearby open crate was filled with hundreds of rounds of 5.56mm ammunition. There were many makes and models of subguns, as well as dozens of semi-automatic blasters, complete with holsters and belts. Heavy assault weaponry occupied the north wall, bazookas, tripod-mounted M249 machine guns, mortars, and rocket launchers. All the ordnance, from the smallest caliber blaster to the Sandcat and Hussar Hotspur Land Rover in an adjacent chamber, were of pre-dark manufacture. Caches of material had been laid down in hermetically sealed continuity of government installations before the nuke cost. Protected from the ravages of the outraged environment, most of the munitions and hardware were as pristine as the day they were rolled off the assembly line. Grant strode to the suit of magistrate body armor mounted on a metal framework in a corner. The framework holding Kane's armor gleamed nakedly in the light. He had suited up at least an hour previously, but Grant preferred to spend as little time as possible inside the exoskeleton. Pieces of it pinched and chafed him in places. Grant removed the pieces from the framework, inspecting each one quickly, habitually. Though relatively lightweight, the polycarbonate was sufficiently dense to deflect every caliber of projectile up to and including a 45 caliber bullet. It absorbed and redistributed the bullet's kinetic impact. Before leaving his quarters, he had donned the Kevlar undersheathing, a black high-collared bodysuit with Velcro tabs at the wrists and ankles. He stepped into the calf-length, thick-treaded boots with their metal-reinforced toes, buckling and strapping them tight. He touched the 14-inch combat knife in the boot scabbard, making sure it was properly sheathed. Domi helped him into the armor. Her slender, petite form was all but swallowed by a dark green, baggy coverall, the uniform of an enclave custodian. A green wool stocking cap concealed most of her white hair. Holstered beneath the coverall, snugged in shoulder leather, was a Detonix 45 Combat Master hand blaster. She had carried it with her on the op to Britain and Ireland, and despite doubts it might be too much gun for such a small girl, she had wielded it with deadly efficiency. A tool bag hung by a strap from her right shoulder, but it held none of the accoutrements of a custodian's trade. It contained two spare ammo clips and three spherical frag grens of the MU-50 series, developed by the military two centuries ago. Domi held up the molded breastplate, connected to the backplate by tiny hinges. Grant stepped into it, and she closed it like a clamshell around his massive torso.
Suck in your gut!
Grant obediently sucked it in, feeling a twinge from his right ribcage, where, 4 days before, several 9mm rounds had pounded. Fortunately, his Kevlar weave coat had prevented penetration. He had been worried about broken or cracked ribs, but DeFore had diagnosed only minor rupturing of the intercostal cartilage. Domi snapped shut all the torso seams while he tugged on the leggings, then the long gauntlets. After he had secured the arm and shin guards, he looked like a statue carved from obsidian. The red disc-shaped badge affixed to the molded left pectoral provided the only spot of color anywhere on the polycarbonate carapace. It depicted a stylized, balanced scales of justice against a nine-spoked wheel, symbolizing the wheel of law in the nine baronies. Grant buckled the holstered sin-eater to his right forearm and tested the spring-release mechanism. The hand blaster leaped into his waiting hand, the butt unfolding and slapping into his palm. It was designed to fire immediately upon touching the crooked forefinger. Satisfied, he pushed the weapon back into the holster and removed the helmet from the framework. He didn't put it on. Tucking it under his left arm, he went to a gun case. From it, he selected his close assault weapon. A chopped-down autoblaster, the copperhead was barely 2 feet in length. The magazine held 15 rounds of 4.85mm steel-jacketed rounds, which could be fired at a rate of 700 rounds per minute. Even with its optical image intensifier and laser auto-target scope, the copperhead weighed less than 8 pounds. From a notched wooden rack at the rear of the case, Grant took a black 6-inch-long cylinder and screwed it carefully into the blaster's bore. The 2-stage sound and muzzle flash arrester suppressed even full auto reports to no more than rustling whispers.
I'm primed. What about you?
As can be.
She gazed up at him uncertainly, as if she wanted to say something else, but unsure of the words to use.
What is it? We're coming up on the jump point.
That doctor lady not warrior like the rest of us. I don't want a babysitter, fat ass.
Domi claimed to be in love with him, viewing him as a gallant black knight who had rescued her from the shackles of Guanateague slavery. In reality, quite the reverse was true. Teague had been crushing the life out of Grant beneath his 300-plus pounds of flab when Domi expertly slit his throat. Regardless of the facts, Domi had attached herself to him, and though her attempts at outright seduction were less frequent, she still made it fiercely clear that Grant was hers and hers alone. Not too long before, she had expressed jealousy of DeFore, suspecting the woman of having designs on Grant. He had no idea if the medic had such an intent. She was a mature woman, certainly attractive, and closer to his own age than Domi, though there was nothing between them but a guarded friendship. Of course, he reflected, he had fought hard to make sure there was nothing but friendship between him and Domi, too, but he feared it was a fight he would eventually lose. He had no idea of Domi's true age, and neither did she. She could be as young as 16 or as old as 26, but either way, he was pushing 40 and felt twice as old. He couldn't deny he was attracted to her youthfulness and her high spirits.
DeFore's not your concern. You will do what Kane and I tell you to do without argument, or you'll be left behind. There's no place on an op for any kind of bullshit. You got me, girl?
Crimson anger glinted in her eyes for a moment. Then she ducked her head, nodding in grudging assent. They left the armory and started down the corridor to the ready room, Domi hurrying to match his long-legged gait.